Fathers. Okay. Anyone knows how to run this thing here? Page in here, yeah? Oui.
Thank you. have everyone sit closer?
Sure, why not? Yeah.
Sure,
just start. Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, great. Okay, so let's just fire it to see what happens. Okay, number one, dear Ajahn, if you can't hear me, let me know, and I'll speak up a little bit. Dear Ajahn, how do I explain to my friends and sometimes to my family members that because I have taken the Thai precepts, I no longer wish to consume alcohol here? It annoys me greatly when they do not respect my decision and continue to get me to drink at every opportunity here. I try to tell myself that they are ignorant and I should be compassionate instead of angry. Should I cut them out of my life? Like, oh, you're going to be very lonely if you cut all your friends out. It doesn't help that they are non-Buddhists. Yes, that is true. I think there are lots of non-Buddhists who don't drink as well. It's quite common among Christians not to drink, and quite common among many people who are sensible that they don't drink very much. So it is of course quite Buddhist, but it's quite common in society here. So I think you can just tell them that, you know, there's a lot of medical advice on that drinking isn't very healthy for you and all those kind of reasons. Lots of good reasons why you shouldn't drink. Yeah. So you can kind of add these things on top of the fact that you are a Buddhist to make kind of a strong case that it is not a good thing to do, right? for medical reasons, for all kind of reasons. So, because otherwise they will probably never understand, because, you know, you are a Buddhist, they are not Buddhist. And if you tell them, they will just, you know, it's not going to work. So you just have to be, sometimes you just have to be firm. You just have to decide, this is my way of life. And if other people don't respect that, it is their problem, right? It's got nothing to do with you. And you just have to stand your ground and do what you think is right. There's no reason to get angry, because that kind of often that feeds their desire to kind of taunt you a little bit if you get angry. But if you're really cool about it and you kind of don't show any emotions when they, even if they taunt you about these things, then after a while they just give up. They're not going to ask you anymore, right? So that is often the best solution, just to be cool. No, I'm not doing this. This is my decision. And they can't really. There's nothing much they can say about that. So as long as you don't try to convert them or to change them or kind of make them follow your ways, then usually you should be fine, I think. Sometimes you just have to. Okay. Anyway. So see what happens and see how things go. Okay, dear Ajahn, does it matter if my heartbeat is very prominent during meditation? Does it matter if your heartbeat is prominent? Doesn't really matter at all. Remember, the important thing in meditation is your state of your mind, not the state of your body. And the body can do all kind of weird things during meditation. All kind of perceptions can arise. Sometimes you can hear the heartbeat, perhaps. But as long as you are feeling okay, as long as you're feeling relaxed, as long as the meditation is kind of heading in the right direction, right? Then you're okay. So don't worry too much about these things, you know, about the heartbeat and that kind of stuff. But if it kind of really gets out of control, right? If it really gets bad, and kind of, then if you kind of feel that you have to call the ambulance or something, then you know. Relax a little bit, otherwise it might be a bit dodgy here. So just be sensible about things. But the fact that you can only hear it is not a big issue, I think, as such. All right. Thanks for the explanation on full awareness this afternoon. If I read that paragraph on full awareness, it seems very similar to Vipassana practice. I wonder if that could also be a possible interpretation. Okay, so this is basically what you are referring to here is the fact that the passage on full awareness is also found in the Satipatthana Sutta, right? When you read the Satipatthana Sutta, it has all the different kind of exercises that you're supposed to do. It starts off, I think, with a breath meditation, and then I can't remember the sequence now. And then I think the four postures of full awareness, and then you have the 32 parts of the body, four elements, and the cemetery contemplation, something like that. I can't remember the exact sequence. There's an interesting study of the Satipatthana Sutta that was done by Ajahn Sujato. He's kind of one of the very interesting scholars on early Buddhism. And he basically concluded that most of these passages were not part of the original Satipatthana Sutta. And the reason you can find these things out is because this has been transmitted in many different languages, right? So it exists in Chinese, in two translations in Chinese. It exists in Pali. It also exists in certain Abhidhamma texts. It exists even in a Mahayana text, the Satipatthana Sutta. So because there are many different versions of it, you can compare these different versions, and on that basis you can decide roughly what are the earliest parts, and most likely to be the most authentic parts of that sutta. And he concluded that the passage on full awareness probably is not part of the original earlier Satipatthana Sutta, which is interesting, right? Because sometimes we think that these things have come down by the Buddha in exactly the same way as the Buddha taught them, come down to us in the same way as the Buddha taught these things. But the reality is that a sutta like the Satipatthana Sutta, it is so different in the Chinese version compared to the Pali version. And it's very easy, because of the structure of the sutta, it's very easy to add new exercises in there, right? Each part is completely independent in a sense. And if you want to add a new part, it's very easy to do that. So probably some of the early Buddhists, they would have thought, yeah, okay, we need to flesh this out a little bit. We add a few parts that obviously belong here. And then they kind of expanded the sutta. So, yes, it is true that very often it is taught as a vipassana thing. But I must admit, I don't really understand how you can gain that much vipassana out of just having full awareness of these activities. Yes, you can be aware of them, but whether it actually leads to any real insight is a different matter. And when we talk about vipassana, normally we refer to insight, right? It's just the same thing with the four postures. If you're just aware of the four postures, it's hard for me to see that you can get any insight into that. You may be able to have awareness of it, but whether it actually gives rise to any insight, I think, is a different matter. The way insight is explained in Buddhism is always about the three characteristics, right? Seeing the khandhas in terms of the three characteristics. That is what insight really is about. So I think that the purpose of this is just to stay cool, right? Stay relaxed, stay easy, the mind not getting out of balance. This, I think, is what this is really about. That is how I would understand this particular practice. Yes? This has the, not really, because the Satipatthana obviously has four parts to it, right? So you have the Kaya Nupassana, Vedana Nupassana, Chitta Nupassana, and Dhamma Nupassana, the four parts. So for the Kaya Nupassana, which means, for those who don't know this word, the body contemplation, for that one, he said that the earliest one is probably the 32 parts of the body here, right? And then after that, quite possibly the four elements as well, because it's something found across all the different versions. So those would probably be the most basic parts of the Satipatthana Sutta. Anapanasati, well, that's different, because Anapanasati fulfills the entire Satipatthana, right? So it actually fulfills all the factors from Kaya Nupassana all the way to Dhamma Nupassana. So it's actually a bit strange that it is included under Kaya Nupassana, because it fulfills the whole thing. Why is it there under Kaya Nupassana? So Anapanasati is something which is very broad. It takes into account the entire range of Satipatthana practices. And then you have the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feelings, contemplation of mind, Chitta Nupassana. They are roughly the same across all different versions, because they're quite straightforward. And then you have the Dhamma Nupassana, the contemplation of principles, as some people say, of causality, because there's a lot of causality in there. And Ajahn Sujato argues that the earliest aspect there is the five hindrances and the seven factors of awakening here. Right? That is kind of the earliest part in that one. So it makes the Satipatthana Sutta quite different when you look at it that particular view. It changes the way it looks quite dramatically, which is very interesting here, because we're used to looking at these things in a very different way here. So when you go to Burma, be careful with these kind of theories, because then the Burmese have very strong views about, not all of them, some of them are very open about these things, but traditionally they have a very strong views about Satipatthana practice. Okay, hi Ajahn Brahmali, is there a recommended text or reference for me to learn more about the Eightfold Path? I have been listening to Ajahn Brahm and your talks on YouTube, which have been extremely useful in my life. Thank you. So basically, the Noble Eightfold Path is pretty much what we are looking at now when we're looking at the gradual training. So the gradual training is really an expanded version of the Noble Eightfold Path. If you look at it carefully, you will recognize all the factors in there, starting with the acquisition of right view, then aiming in the right direction and moving all the way through the Noble Eightfold Path. I explained this in the beginning on the first day, but maybe some of you weren't here at that time. So that is a very good way of learning about the Noble Eightfold Path. And that is the first sutta that has been given out to you. So check out that first sutta, and that will kind of give you a good idea what the path is about. Beyond that, I know that there is a booklet written by Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi on the Noble Eightfold Path, which is quite nice. But it's a little bit perhaps commentaries oriented sometimes, a little bit kind of Abhidhamma style. If you just go for the suttas, then the gradual training, I think, is probably the best one. Majjhima Nikaya 27, also the further expanded version of the gradual training is found in the Digha Nikaya, like the Digha Nikaya number 2, Samanyapala Sutta, the fruits of the recluse life? So of the the fruits of basically of being a samana, of being an ascetic, of being a monastic, that's what it means. So those are all good things. Also, what you can do, you can go to the Sanyutta Nikaya, the last book of the Sanyutta Nikaya, you find the Sanyutta on the Noble Eightfold Path. It is called the Magga. It's called the Magga Sanyutta, I think it's called. And you find that towards the end of the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's also very nice, lots of short discourses on the Noble Eightfold Path, which is very very handy and very useful. One of the things about the Sanyutta Nikaya, when you first look at it, it looks really boring, right? Because you have all these suttas that look exactly the same, and then you have one word change from one sutta to the next one. You think, oh no, exactly the same thing again, just one word change. And you think it is really, really boring. But actually, it's quite interesting, because if you have one word change like that, it means that you can focus on a very single aspect of what is going on there. And you can understand things with great clarity when only one word is changed, right? And it gives you a kind of different context in which this particular sutta is used and how it works. And this is also the case with the Noble Eightfold Path. So when you read that, there's only small changes as you go along here. Then you can see how the details are actually worked out in a certain way here. And that's it actually can be very useful here. So check it out. So there's quite a large number of suttas there on the Noble Eightfold Path, which actually is I think is very useful here. Okay. Dear Ajahn, sometimes when I meditate, I feel as if I'm leaving my body, floating away. Okay. Maybe take a rope and tie yourself down so you don't, just in case. Provide you with some kind of anchor so you don't kind of go anywhere. And I get myself back. Wonder if I should just let it go and see where I float to. Please advise. Yes, that is always good fun, right? See where you float to. And you know that you are... when you hit your head against the ceiling, that's when you know that you really are floating. Yeah? So if you can show off a bump afterwards, then we will take it seriously. But seriously, what is going on here is usually just a perception. It's the mind making these kind of things up. It's very common for people to have these things happen, right? They are floating, the body is expanding. You have a famous Ajahn Chah who famously had the sense of his body exploding, and all these organs were hanging off the branches of a tree, right? So you had kind of the liver hanging over there, the heart was over here, the intestines were over there. So imagine that. That's quite a very elaborate perception to have in your meditation practice. But all of these things are basically just creations of the mind, right? The mind is making these things up, so you don't have to worry too much about it. If you really were floating, usually it means your meditation would be going really, really well already. You probably have some good samadhi and these kind of things. And even then, it's very rare that people actually start floating. It's not something you have to worry too much about. It's not a primary concern in meditation practice. So just enjoy, just allow the perception to work its way out. Don't try to control it. If you try to control it, you tend to mess things up and make it worse, right? So just sit back and relax and just enjoy the ride and see what happens. And sometimes it's just good fun to see what the mind can create. The mind is incredibly creative. If you look around the world, one of the interesting things that Buddha says about the mind, for example, if you look at the animal realm, right? Animal realm, incredibly diverse. Animals from the kind of tiniest insects to the snakes, to the birds, to the lions, to the everything, very, very diverse realm. And of course, ultimately, it's all created by the mind, right? You have to have a mind state which matches that particular rebirth in order to get reborn there. So in the end, it's all a creation of the mind, really. So the mind can do all kind of weird things then. So just enjoy the vitta. Okay. Dear Ajahn Brahmali, isn't desire for enlightenment another form of desire? A defilement. Some folks really want to have mind-blowing spiritual experiences, reach high levels of samadhi. Isn't it just another form of desire? Perhaps subtle mind desire versus gross bodily desire. Okay, yes, it is definitely a form of desire. You can't really deny that. That's true. But remember that what we are trying to overcome on the Buddhist path is not just any desire, at least not initially. The initial problem is sensual desire, or desire that you get through the five senses. That is the main problem. Right? So that is the thing that we are trying to avoid. When the suttas say you have the intention or the aim of renunciation, it specifically means the renunciation of the five senses and the desires that relate to that. That is the problem. This is what ties you down. This is what distorts your outlook. This is what blocks your access to samadhi, right? That's why this is what you want to overcome. So this is the main thing. Now, the desire for enlightenment or the desire for samadhi, you're going to have a little bit of desire for that. Because if you have no desire for it, you're not going to do anything, right? You're not going to come here. You're not going to bother sitting with your legs cross-legged. You're just going to go to the beach or something instead, right? This is the reality of things. You have to have some driving force that gets you started on this path. And you can go, even if you have a bit of desire in your meditation initially, you can go quite a long way with that. But towards the very end, when the meditation becomes very peaceful, you have to let go of all desire at that point. So at that point, there is no more desire. And then afterwards, when you come out again, the desire re-arises. But a bit of desire is to be expected. What we're trying to get away from is the sensual desire. But even that, if you are living an ordinary lay life, don't be too hung up about sensual desires. It is part and parcel of life. It is what most people, what you can expect to some extent in lay life is to have some sensual desire. And it's one of the reasons why people choose to live lay life compared to monastic life. So don't worry too much about that. What we really should be concerned about is the ill will and the cruelty and that kind of stuff, because it is very, very destructive. The Buddha says in the suttas very nicely that anger, ill will, is easy to overcome and greatly to be blamed, right? It's very blameworthy, and it leads to very bad results, both in this life and also in future lives. So it's a major problem. Whereas sensual desire is not so greatly to be blamed. It's not such a big deal. After all, you're just kind of enjoying yourself. As long as you do that without harming anybody, it's not a major problem, right? Kind of makes sense. But it can be very hard to overcome. And especially if you live a life, maybe you are married or you have a partner in life, right? Then there is a clash there between the ideals of renunciation on the one hand and the demands of that kind of partnership on the other hand. So that clash, the sensuality, is always going to win out. So, to some extent, you just have to... That's what lay life is like. To some extent, you have to go with that flow. And then when you go on a retreat sometimes, a slightly stricter retreat than this, when you go on the 8 precepts and that kind of thing, then you can leave aside all the sensuality for a while, and then maybe your meditation can deepen a bit more as a consequence. So you can test yourself out. But I wouldn't be too worried about that if I were you. It might end up making your life very miserable otherwise. Okay. So there you are. Okay. On the back it says, with much metta and gratitude. Here's the question. Better take the question, otherwise you get very disappointed. Okay, dear Ajahn, thank you very much for your wonderful teachings. I have 3 questions, okay? It looks like there's enough already, and each one has 3, right? That is really, really tricky. Okay, question number 1. Presumably, your sister was a beginning meditator. With guided meditation of Ajahn Brahm, did you start Which guided meditation, Rajan Brahm, did you start your sister with, please? Okay. I'm not sure, actually, because I asked somebody else to compile all those meditations. She used to be the old caretaker at Jhana Grove. You may know her, Dania. And she was this incredibly devout Ajahn Brahm disciple. She listened to all his talks backwards and forwards and in reverse and in all kind of all kind of possibilities, right? Really, really devout. So because she listened to everything, because I've been Ajahn Brahm disciple for 22 years, I don't listen to all the lay teachings he gives anymore. So I asked her to put something together. And she did it and sent it off to my sister. And that's what she got. But if you wish, I think I still have that compilation somewhere. So if you are interested, I'll be very happy to email them to you, or email them to Angel, she can forward it to you, or whatever. So if you're interested, let me know, and I'll give you that compilation if you wish. I need to make some good karma as well, so I'll help you out. Okay. I have found myself repeatedly overcome by sleepiness, especially at the start of meditation. This despite coming to the end of the retreat. Is this an issue? I find sometimes it passes, the meditation then becomes quite nice, but other time I end up sleeping for 45 minutes. Please advise. Okay, so this is a very, very common problem. And even some of the very best meditators, they have problems with sleepiness, at least in the beginning, just like you have. So this is just really par for the course. One of the meditators I know, he is a very good meditator, he says every time he sits down, he starts off by nodding, right? And he nods away for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then he kind of brightens up, and his mind becomes clear. Usually he has a very bright and clear mind. The mind clarifies, and then his meditation is strong after that. Right? So that is perfectly okay. So just relax. Don't fight these things. Is it a problem? Well, it's quite natural. You come from a life which probably is very busy, right? You come here, you are tired initially, and then that's what happens. Or maybe, you know, even just walking around and doing a few things can make you sometimes a little bit tired. So don't worry about that. Allow it to be. Allow the mind to kind of rest a little bit. And then if the mind gets better, wonderful. If it doesn't, so be it. But don't try to fight it or force it. Otherwise, you tend to make it worse. Okay, number three. The Buddha speaks about Kalyanamitta as the whole of the spiritual life. Yet he also repeatedly talks about the importance of seclusion in supporting the development of the Eightfold Path. How should we make sense of this? Especially since many Buddhist societies tend to use the former to justify all types of social activities, some which are probably more ayoniso manasikara, gossiping, overeating, etc. Please advise. Okay. So the point is, if you think that Kalyanamitta is everything, and that means you can do everything else exactly what you like, that is kind of missing the point, right? That is not what it means. What it means is that for you to be able to understand the path, you need the Kalyanamitta of the Buddha in the first place. So he is the one that actually enables you to understand what the path is. And because you have faith and confidence in the Buddha, you practice according to that path. That is actually what it means. And then if you need a little bit of inspiration, you need a little bit of a push to kind of get you moving, then you read the suttas again, or you listen to an inspiring talk. You come to one of Ajahn Brahm's talks in Singapore, right, with the other 1,000 people or whatever it is. You have a good laugh, but you take on board some of the message as well. And then that keeps you going again in the future and carries you forward. So the point here is not that it is just Kalyanamitta and then you can just go out and get drunk or whatever. That's not the point. The point is that Kalyanamitta is the support for everything else on the path. So when the Buddha says all of these other things, it means that you take it seriously, precisely because the Buddha is a Kalyanamitta, right? When the Buddha says you should keep the five precepts, when the Buddha says you should go into seclusion sometimes, right? When the Buddha says you should ordain, right? You should take that seriously, right? You shouldn't mess around. You should get going. This is what he says. So all of these things are there to be taken seriously. That's why the Buddha says that. I'm always astonished that people sometimes think they can dismiss things like rebirth. But if you are a Buddhist and the Buddha says there is a rebirth, it seems to me that you have to take it seriously. You can't just dismiss it. You can't say, you know, it doesn't matter. If the Buddha says so, it must be important, right? So this is a kind of... this is basically how we should think. I think the Buddha says somewhere that the right way of thinking about your relationship to the Buddha is to think that the Buddha is a teacher, I am the disciple. Right? The Buddha is a teacher, I am the disciple. In other words, you need to listen to what he has to say, because he is a teacher in this relationship. Just as when you go to school, you listen to the teacher. So I hope that makes sense to you. And... okay. Hi, Ajahn. Thank you for sharing your wisdom with us on this retreat. I would like to know if it's possible to get people, in particular my family members, interested in Buddhism. Or do I let nature take its course? Like saying, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. I'm just worried that the student is never ready. Okay, so how do you get your family members interested in Buddhism? Right? I think I talked about that a bit before, about my own experience about that, because my family members are pretty much Buddhist now, actually, perhaps with the exception of my sister, but the rest of them are pretty much become Buddhists. And the way I mean, of course, as a monk, you have a bit more authority, perhaps, even with your parents, because you are showing a great deal of commitment, right? Especially when you've been a monk for 20 years, over 20 years now, as I have, then, of course, you have proven yourself. It's not just the passing phase of youthful enthusiasm. It's more than that, right? Oh, he's just young. Actually, he's over 50 now, so maybe not so young anymore. There comes a point when you even your child is no longer kind of a baby anymore here. So, but really what I found is that the most powerful thing is always the power of example, right? If you show that you can love your family members unconditionally without placing demands on them, if you show that your Buddhist practice is bearing fruit, you are changing and all of these kind of things, then usually after a while your family will certainly respect you for that, at the very least. Even if they don't become Buddhist, they will start to respect your Buddhist practice because they see that something is going on. I think one of the most powerful things is to have... No. The most powerful thing is to have like an external authority that your family can trust, right? And this is the great thing with having a teacher like Ajahn Brahm or any other teacher who people can just go and listen to, and you can tell them, just come along and just listen to a few jokes at the very least. You get a good laugh, right? Everybody gets a good laugh with Ajahn Brahm. At least you get a good laugh, and everybody likes to have a bit of entertainment, so you can't really lose out. If you want to reject the Buddhist message, so be it, but let's go and have a bit of fun together. And this is how you can maybe get people interested, possibly, maybe not, but it's one way of doing it, right? And often, when people hear an external authority like Ajahn Brahm, they are much more likely to listen than if you, who are the family members, say so, because you are too close to each other. It's very difficult to listen to family members. And this is also in part what happened to my family. You know, I gave them books about Ajahn Brahm and that sort of thing. And then gradually things turned around as a consequence. And sometimes it doesn't work at all, and then you just have to be happy with whatever. Be happy with your own practice and not be too concerned about what happens to the student who is never ready. Okay, dear Ajahn, regarding funerals, are you saying that there is no need to have monks officiate the funeral completely? No need to chant or perform any rituals at all? If so, how would people know that the dead is a Buddhist? Thank you. Well, people don't have to know, right? what matter in Buddhism is the fact that you have Buddhists in your heart. That's the only thing that matters. Whether other people know or not is really quite irrelevant. But, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't have a Buddhist monk to do some chanting. Sometimes that can be nice to do, right? Sometimes that can kind of give a good atmosphere at the funeral ceremony, and especially if it is a wise monk who says a few nice words at the same time, it makes everybody kind of calm down a bit, right? Not cry too much, because sometimes people just cry and cry at these funerals. It is kind of way over the top. So all of these can be very good things. So just feel out the situation. But if you don't feel like having a Buddhist monk there, there's no absolute need for these kind of things. So, you know, it's neither right nor wrong, right? You have to know for yourself what you want to do with these kind of things. Okay, dear Ajahn, besides the suttas, should lay people also study the Vinaya? How should one study the Vinaya? If yes, thank you. Should you study the Vinaya? I wouldn't really recommend it, to be honest. It's very, very boring, very dry. And the difference between the Vinaya and the suttas is that the suttas are often really inspiring, right? They are about all the beautiful things the monks and the nuns and the lay Buddhists were doing at that time. Sometimes very uplifting stories. You read the verses in the Theragata, very beautiful verses about the ideas of awakening, how they practice the path and all these kind of things. And you feel often so inspired, right, when you see these things. And then you get to the Vinaya, and the Vinaya is all about the dodgiest monks, right, the really bad and really dodgy ones. And you think, oh no, the monks surely didn't do this. That's terrible. How can they do such a thing? And it can be really dispiriting when you read these kind of stories. There is actually one advantage of reading those kind of stories. Sometimes people think that at the time of the Buddha, monks and people were way up there, right? They were almost enlightened already, because surely if you get reborn at the time of the Buddha, it means your karma is really good. This is the kind of argument you always see, right? Until you read the Vinaya and you realize people then were exactly like people are today, full of defilements, full of doing kind of bad things, and all kind of trying to get away from the rules and trying their best to kind of not having to do things, just the same today as they were then, or just the same, yeah. So, and that is the beautiful thing about it. It makes it clear that if people could become enlightened then, so can they now. People are basically the same, and because the teachings are still available, there is no real difference between those days and these days. This is actually the good thing about the Vinaya. But the Vinaya is not very interesting. Actually, that's an exaggeration. The Vinaya can be actually quite interesting. But it's much more interesting if you are a monastic. As a layperson, it can get quite tedious to read the Vinaya. But it is now getting available. I'm actually translating the whole Vinaya Pitaka myself. I'm kind of getting towards the end of that project now. And it will all be uploaded to Sutta Central eventually. So you can read my translation if you like. It's quite an easy-to-read translation. So if you wish to do so, please do so. But if you find it boring and not inspiring, then there's no actual need to read the Vinaya, basically. So you don't really learn much. Remember that morality is described in the gradual training. You're not going to learn much morality from the Vinaya. The Vinaya are just tiny rules of, you know, don't do this, don't do that for people who are basically don't understand what they should be doing here. If you're able to practice kindness in ordinary life, then you are fine. That's really all you need to know. And the rest is just details. Yes, sir.
From a big business
aspect,
like Ramakaya,
I'm
not aware of what the rules are.
Yeah.
And the monks go ahead and kind of do their thing.
Yeah.
And tell the ladies,
yeah,
not your business
now. Sure, that's a very good point. And but what I would recommend, there are other books about the Vinaya that are much more suitable for lay people. There's one called The Lay People's Guide to the Vinaya, or something like that, which I think is available online. And that was originally put together by a bhikkhu called Ariyesako, who is disrobed now, but he was one who put it together. And that is very good, because it gives you the basic ideas of what a monastic is supposed to be, not using money and that kind of stuff, you know, basic things. And I think you're right. I think that the idea that lay people should have some idea what monastics should be up to, so they can make it an informed judgment, right? Are these scallywag monks, or are they good monks? Are they good nuns or bad nuns? Right? And I think that actually is important to be aware of that. Yes, thank you for that. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, thank you for your effort in producing the kindfulness book. I understand that there was limited quantity, and I am fortunate to have a copy. It will be be great if more of the book can be published for others to learn and enjoy meditation. Yes, that was actually produced in part by Dira Yupa. She's not here now. She's one of the Thai ladies who comes here. And she was the one who put that together. And I did a lot of the proofreading and that sort of stuff. And it's going to be published by Wisdom Publications. I think they are in the process of doing that now. So it's going to be coming out relatively soon. But of course, when it is through Wisdom, it is going to have a price tag on, unfortunately. So that is one of those things, right? I was reading recently. I don't know if you saw that. I saw the list from Wisdom Publications in the U.S. Wisdom Publications is perhaps the largest Buddhist publisher in the West, certainly in the U.S. And they had this catalog, right, of all the books they publish. And the first page were the bestsellers of Wisdom Publications. Now, this bestsellers had 19 books on this bestseller list, right? These are kind of bestsellers, all-time bestsellers or whatever. Three of those books were Ajahn Brahm books, right? And there was only one other author who had more than one book, and that was Bhante Gunaratana, who had two, and everybody else had one book. And this is why Wisdom Publication, they love Ajahn Brahm, right? Please write more books. We can make so much money. We can subsidize everything else. This is basically how things work. They love Ajahn Brahm. But that also tells you how famous he is, right? I mean, if this is in the West. I mean, he's far, far more famous in Asia. And the reason is because in Asia, the Buddhist population is so large. But I think among the Buddhist population in the West, perhaps even more famous percentage-wise. But in Asia, there are far, far more people who are Buddhists. So for that reason, he's even more famous here in many ways. He is kind of, it's kind of ridiculous sometimes. But that's the way it is. Okay, anyway, let's move on to the next one. Myth or truth, if I listen to calm, beautiful chanting music out loud, will spirits be drawn to this because they too feel the peace, thus attracting many unwanted spirits into my house and room? Oh, well, first of all, I don't really think the spirits will be too attracted, because many of these spirits, they will already, you know, if they are heavenly spirits, their music is much better, right? They don't want to come down to your kind of dodgy, you know, ordinary music. Your stereo system is nothing compared to the system they have there. So for that, you don't have to worry about that. But if you do attract spirits by beautiful chanting, because that's what they often say in the Buddhist world, the monks chant, and then we invite the devas to come and listen as well. If they do come, wow, you should be so glad. These will be really wholesome spirits, right? If they are interested in hearing Buddhist chanting, maybe they can understand it if they understand the Pali language. These are the kind of deities that will protect you and look after you. And you should be so happy if they come into your house. This is not the scary variety. This is the nice variety of spirits. And you know what it says in the suttas? It says that if you live a very moral and good life, the deities will look after you. The devas will come and protect you, right? So maybe this is part of that. You live well, you play a bit of chanting, the devas come there and they support you when you have a difficult time or whatever. Yeah. That's a wonderful thing. So you should be really happy about that if that happens. Nothing to worry about. And the ghosts, if there are ghosts around, they're not going to be interested in the music. They will be interested in you giving them a bit of merit or whatever. So no need to worry about those either. So there's nothing to worry about. Just enjoy, as I say. Okay. Dear Ajahn. Ooh, another three questions. Okay. I recall reading somewhere that there are five forces that shape our lives. Karma is one, others being biological, physical, psychic. I wonder if this concept is found in the suttas or later works. These are the five laws. They're called niyamas in Pali. And they are not found in the suttas. They are found in later literature in Buddhism. So I don't know. I don't think they are all that important. This is more like when Buddhism becomes speculative, right? This is what happens after the Buddha passes away. The Buddha is very pragmatic. He only teaches a path. This is what you have to do, and you overcome suffering that way. And then when the Buddha passes away, people think, yeah, I'm not really satisfied with his teaching. He didn't explain everything in detail, right? What about the laws of the universe, right? We need to say something about the laws. And then start writing these things down. And this is where a lot of the speculation and the philosophy arise from. It arises from the fact that Buddha passes away. People want to fill in all the perceived gaps. They think there are gaps in the teaching. In one way, there is gaps. But another way, I think those gaps are there on purpose, because it's not necessary here. It's that very famous simile of the handful of leaves in the Singsapa Grove. You know that simile? Yeah? Famous simile, right? The Buddha takes up a handful of leaves. These leaves compares to the teaching here. Just as this is like what I have taught you, and the rest of the leaves in the forest is what I know. So the same comparisons of the few leaves in his hand to the leaves in the forest is compared to what he has taught, compared to what he knows. So this is the thing, and there's a reason why the Buddha doesn't teach these things, right? It's a sidetrack. Maybe it is uncertain whether it is correct if it is in the commentaries. So no need to worry about that. Number two, on collective karma again. I wonder, was the sutta silent on this concept? Or did the sutta specifically say that it is not possible? The sutta doesn't really say anything about this. The sutta just says that karma is intention. And intention is always individual, right? I think it comes from that basically. This idea of collective karma is something that you find in a kind of New Age circles, perhaps some Hindu circles as well, but it's not something you find in Buddhism. Number three, lastly, can we ask questions using the microphone rather than writing them down on paper? I find it more lively and interactive this way. Or are we trying to keep talking to a minimum? I think the idea on a retreat like this is to keep the talking down. I agree with you. Sometimes it's really nice to have more interactive. But maybe there's a time for interaction. There's a time for having less interaction, right? Maybe this is a nice way of doing things when you are on a retreat. At Dharma Grove, we always do things this way. We don't have interaction directly to have less of the spoken word, which actually is quite nice. It works out very well there. But of course, if I go to the BF Center or I go to the Dhammaloka Center in Perth or whatever, then of course there's always much more verbal interaction, which also is nice. It's a different kind of exchange, right? Is it working? Oh, okay. Wow. Okay, it is working. Okay, shall we use the microphone or shall we just continue the way we're doing things? Is the microphone better? It's working as well. Oh, everything working. Okay, wow. So I will use this one then. This one is good. Okay, no? Yes? Is it working? Is it a bit? Maybe the volume needs to... Is the volume okay? Yeah. Well, it's fine. Okay. So if you want to go back and sit up again and relax and chill, please do so. It's up to you, whatever you like to do. But you can, if you want to sit up again, that's fine. Yeah. Okay. Okay, dear Ajahn, can I ask if you are working on any projects, e.g. translation, writing a book, etc.? Just curious. And I just mentioned that before, that one of my projects is to translate the Vinaya Pitaka. I'm doing that
from Pali into English. Which is very nice. It needs to be done. There isn't really any good translation on that. It's one of the things I'm very happy to do. And it would be available for free for everyone, which is great, right, on the internet. And hopefully it will also get published in book form as well. And that's kind of the idea anyway. And do you often interact with monastics of other traditions? Mahayana, Vajrayana, what do you all discuss? Yeah, you wonder. Sometimes we do, especially in Australia, because in Australia we have this kind of cross-tradition organization called the Australian Sangha Association, which includes Sangha from all the different traditions. Yeah, so sometimes we come together, and basically the things that we discuss are things in common for all the different traditions, right? Things that need to be resolved. The reason you have these kind of organizations is more to resolve things vis-a-vis the government and that kind of stuff. So we don't really talk that much Dhamma usually with these with monks from other traditions. But you can, because there is a lot of crossover between the different traditions. That yes, there are differences, of course, but if you focus on those things we have in common, actually it's remarkable how much there is in common between the different traditions, and that creates a sense of harmony. Just mentioning the other day, I think Angie was bringing up the point about the Dalai Lama, and one of the nice things about him is that he also tends to be very low key, focus on the basic teachings, right, not all the highfalutin stuff, the tantric stuff and that kind of stuff. But the basic teachings of Dhamma is what he also focuses on. And then it's very easy to have a conversation with people of other traditions. But usually, there is no point in having too much conversations, right? Because you live in a monastery, you have a teacher like Ajahn Brahm. I'm very committed to Ajahn Brahm as my teacher. I don't feel I need to have all that many different people to teach me. I have the Buddha, I have Ajahn Brahm. That's enough. I'm happy with that. Right? Don't want to go too far beyond that. Of course, sometimes you do have discussions. The kind of people I discuss with Buddhism is people like Ajahn Sujato, right? People like Bhikkhu Bodhi. People like Venerable Analayo, who is both a very good meditator and also a very good scholar. Sometimes you find these exceptional people who are both really good meditators and really good scholars at the same time. People like Venerable Nyanatusita, he is the president of the Buddhist Publication Society. All of these people are like my monastic friends, and these are people I communicate with. And all of them are really good scholars. It's really great to be able to have that kind of friendships, right? Because it means the depth of the quality of the research, the quality of understanding actually is very, very high. And then you have people like Ajahn Brahm, and you have the Buddha, everything coming together very nicely. So I'm very satisfied with the contacts I have in my monastic life. Sometimes also you meet people, like people here in Thailand, who are very, obviously very highly developed in meditation. People like Ajahn Gamha, right? If you ask him about the Vinaya or about scholastic things, he doesn't know anything at all. Really has very little understanding of those things. But he's a very, very beautiful person. And that, of course, in the end, is even more important, right? To have those attainments, to have the depth of understanding in your heart. So there's so many good things coming together. So it's very, which is very nice and very beautiful. Okay. Dear Ajahn, in the Sutta on the five kinds of persons, we get the sense that the actions in the similes are becoming more and more subtle as we deal with more and more defiled people. So the rag, right? The tearing the rag, cupping the hands to drink water, sipping water with the hands, wishing welfare for a person from afar. Yes, that is true. So here we see kind of a deterioration, right? The person becoming more and more defiled. That's true. Is the Sutta hinting to us to be more careful, tactful, as we deal with people who are more defiled? Thank you. Yes, I think that is probably a good point, right? If people have a lot of problems and there are lots of defilements, if you are not careful, it might kind of cause problems for you. I think that is actually an important point. But I think the main issue here is how The main issue is actually how we think about these people. It's not so much about how we interact with them, but how we relate to them in our own mind. So the point here is that when somebody has some defilements, you focus on the good aspects. If somebody has a lot of defilements, but only a few good aspects to them, you have to narrow down your field of vision very narrowly. Just focus on that. If you look a little bit far that way, oops, defilements. Look far that way, oops, more defilements. So you have to focus down very narrowly and stick to that. Otherwise, you see all the stuff you don't really want to see. So I think that is really the main point there. And with the last person, that is just another way of dealing with people altogether, where you have compassion rather than metta. Right? So I think that is the main thing. It's not so much how we deal with them in ordinary life, but it has more to do with our personal interaction with them in our mind, how we think about them. That is the main issue there. Okay. Dear Ajahn, how should we teach children 5 to 7 years old about handling loss? Are they too young to understand rebirth and impermanence? Thank you. It's amazing. Children can pick up a lot of things, right? It's just somewhat astonishing how much they can understand, even if they are young. So sometimes you can give them a little bit of teachings, right? Say, okay, your granny, she has probably gone to a nice rebirth now. She's kind of hanging out there just enjoying herself, right? Something like that. You can say these things. And that will basically, they will understand that as rebirth. Usually, in my experience, you don't have to worry too much about children. Children tend to be very resilient. They have it much better at dealing with these issues than grown-ups usually, right? Grown-ups are the ones that usually sorrow and grieve the most when things go wrong. Children usually handle these things fairly well, at least up to a certain age. So you can tell them about these things. But probably the person who needs it more than your kids, right? Because you're probably harder for you to deal with impermanence than actually for the little children. So test it out, you know, if you are interested in teaching them about these kind of things, and give it a shot and see what happens. Say it in a nice way, and then see how they take that. It might be interesting. Okay, dear Ajahn, what can one say to friends who is always saying, this is God's will, this is Buddha's will? Thank you very much. This is God's will, right? Okay, this sounds like one of those Muslim things, right? The Muslims always say, may God's will, may Allah's will prevail, or something like that. What you can say to them, you can ask them, how do you know it's God's will? Have you got some kind of direct connection with God or something? People say this kind of random stuff because they don't really want to think about it. I think that is often what is going on there. They want some kind of explanation, and they're happy with that, and don't have to think too much about it. So maybe all you have to do is to remind them of the uncertainty of this, and to remind them that most things in the world have causes, right? It's very obvious when you look at that. Things have causes, and consequences come from those causes. And that is really why things are happening. To say that things are God's will is a cop-out. You're not really looking at things very clearly or carefully. If it is God's will, nothing you can do about it. But we know very well that we have influence in the world, right? We know that how we act, how we live, how we govern things actually matters. So it's kind of silly to go around saying things are God's will. Even more silly to say it is Buddha's will. Or just as silly, Buddha is not around. I'm not sure how he could have any influence at all. He died 2,500 years ago, right? It's too late for the Buddha to have any impact. So maybe ask your friend to think a little bit before he makes too many statements of this sort. Okay. Dear Ajahn, when I meditate, I make myself at ease. But it always follows with sleeping, and it seems to have become a habit. How do I overcome the sleepiness? Thank you, lots of metta. Don't again it mean that if you are falling asleep, at the very least you are relaxing. So that's good. Many people have a hard time just relaxing properly. So it means at the very least you are, you know, you are enjoying it at least to some extent, which is great. So if you fall asleep, there are two reasons why people fall asleep in meditation. One is that you are just tired because you've been working too hard, and your mind is in the habit of always working. So even when you come on retreat, the mind kind of carries on working, right? Thinking about this, thinking about that. And then whenever you sit down, you fall asleep again because too much work is going on there. Even though you have pulled yourself out of your workplace and your family, still you have those bad habits that carry over. So this is one thing. Another reason why you are sleepy sometimes is because there isn't enough happiness and joy in the mind. You haven't practiced the foundation stones of the path enough yet. But if you keep on focusing on the foundations, on the basis for everything else, being kind, being generous, having a good heart, thinking kind thoughts about people, right? Do this. If you keep on doing this, if you take every opportunity, if you remind yourself how much impact you can have on people around you, what a wonderful gift you can give to people around you just by saying the right thing and doing the right thing at the right time. Wow, it's astonishing what we can do for other people by doing things in the right way. If you think like that and you act accordingly, then over the months, over the years, you will find that your mind starts to lift, right? It becomes more clear, less dark, brighter, more beautiful, and you're kind of lifting yourself up, floating up like a balloon. It's very beautiful when that happens. You feel like you're becoming a more beautiful and wholesome person. It takes time, takes months, takes years sometimes, but wow, there's nothing more worthwhile to do in your entire life than doing just that. And as part of that, you will overcome that sleepiness problem as well. The main reason why there is sleepiness there really comes from the first two hindrances. The habits is one thing, but also the first two hindrances are the main problem: sensual desire and ill will. Ill will really is really bad for causing sleepiness. So if you have a little bit of tendency to get upset with people or irritated or whatever, and try to learn some of the things I've been teaching here, overcoming that ill will, overcoming that negativity. Remember the similes of the people, right? Look at the good sides, forgive them for their faults, because basically they just don't know what they're doing, just like we don't know what we're doing when we are being stupid, right? Same kind of thing here. So you don't have to feel superior either, because we're all in the same boat. And as you do that, your perception will change, your outlook will change, the way of thinking will change, everything will change. And then you will overcome that sleepiness gradually, gradually, gradually. And then over time, maybe even some of the sensuality you can put behind you, and then you overcome even more sleepiness. Because sensuality tends to drain some of the energy of the mind. If there's less of that, there's more energy in the mind as well there. Okay, so maybe a couple of more questions, and then we will we can maybe do a longer session tomorrow if there's lots of questions tomorrow. So we'll see what happens there. Please guide us to experience the experience of no thought, no thinking. Okay, it seems like the mind is always working, generating thoughts continuously, even as we sleep. And that's kind of a slightly unhappy mouth at the end there. Yes, that is true. The mind tends to be very active, right? Always thinking, always concocting things, always making things up. The mind is this incredibly creative part that creates everything pretty much. And the reason why the mind is so active and creative is basically because we wanted to do those things. And this is the core problem, the core reason. We actually want to think, right? We want to dream. We want all of these kind of things. So what we have to do is we have to find something that is better than the thinking mind, something that is more pleasurable, more happy than the thinking all the time. And then the thinking stops, right? So the first thing to do is just to notice in your meditation, nobody thinks all the time. There's always going to be small gaps in the thinking here. So notice those small gaps and just feel what it feels like. This is often the first thing to do. And you will see that when the thinking stops, right? You see what I mean? The thinking stops, right? Is there a kind of a trick to make you stop thinking? You just kind of stop halfway in the sentence and you were kind of waiting, right? So you stop thinking at that point, and if you feel what it feels like, actually, it is quite beautiful there. It's peaceful. It's nice. And once you get into that beauty and you start what that beauty is all about, then the mind begins to incline more to that same kind of peace. This is part of it. Just feel the peace for yourself. And the other aspect is then to have something which really makes you happy. And this is why we're talking about all of these things, like being kind and generous and overcoming all these negative things. Because you start to feel happy inside of yourself. And that happiness makes it very nice to be quiet. Because the happiness is much more interesting than the thinking mind. So because it is more interesting, you'd rather hang out with the happiness in the present moment, being mindful, rather than thinking about stuff. So the more happiness you have, the happiness of the... Because this happiness is happiness of the present moment. It's happiness that you have here and now, while you are mindful, because you have done many good things in the past, and you've lived a good life. So it draws the mind into the present moment. The present moment becomes the pleasant moment, right? Easy thing to remember. And then it is easy to be mindful, easy not to think. So again, you can see this path is an integrated thing. All the factors come together. You cannot develop one without the others. They all belong together in a sense. And then everything tends to fall into place as a consequence. Yeah. Maybe not, perhaps. These are things, you know, when I say these things, I remember that the best kind of wisdom is the wisdom that you find yourself. So when you meditate, always reflect on the meditation, contemplate what you are doing. And those things, those understandings that you have yourself while you're meditating, far more powerful than anything I can say or any teacher can say. Because that is direct experience. Wow, this really is true, right? This really works. This is the way to do it. That is going to be the most powerful thing for you. So I'm not saying that what I'm saying is wrong. I hope it isn't. Otherwise, that would be terrible if I gave you all kind of terrible ideas. Hopefully it is a little bit right, guiding in the right direction. But then use your own wisdom. Find your own wisdom inside. And when you do that, that will become incredibly powerful for you, including understanding how the thinking mind operates, how to get out of it. All of that is part and parcel of the same thing here. Okay, so that's enough for this evening. These haven't been answered yet, so just leave that there. And we will do that tomorrow. And you can please feel free to add more questions there if you like. So now I'll just wish you all a very nice night's sleep. Enjoy, have a good rest, and then we'll see you again tomorrow morning. And let's just pay respect to Buddha Mahasangha first.